Turn in your Bibles to Habakkuk and chapter 2. Habakkuk and chapter 2. While you are turning there, let me again welcome you to our ongoing sermon series entitled Major Lessons in the Minor Prophets. I was surprised to discover that it's actually a title of a book. And I was about to order the book when I discovered that it was written by a Seventh-day Adventist. Well, I gave up on that score. So perhaps I will be the one to write a more Protestant sound commentary or something. Okay, so we've been on this journey. We have studied Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, and we are now in the book of Habakkuk. And this is our third installment in this book. In the first one, what we basically saw was Habakkuk complaining to God concerning the depraved situation that was in Judah. At this point, as we've already seen, Israel, the first 10 tribes, are already in captivity. God is already punishing them. There had been warning after warning by a number of the prophets. They never listened, and they are now in captivity. Now it is Judah. And Judah seems to be going downhill very quickly. We are seeing it in this complaint by Habakkuk. However, when Habakkuk made that complaint, God responded to that complaint by basically saying that he was raising up the Chaldeans, whom he called that bitter and hasty nation, who were currently marching through the breadth of the earth, seizing dwellings that were not their own. And they were going to come and wreak havoc upon the two tribes that were remaining, including Jerusalem, that was their headquarters. So that was the first message. Then we went on to see Habakkuk's second complaint in the second sermon. And basically, his second complaint was, Lord, how do you use a nation that is more wicked to punish a nation that is less wicked than themselves? The mathematics were not adding up in the mind of this prophet. And as he put his complaint, his second complaint, before the Lord, this time he's really complaining about the Lord himself. We noted how he then said he was going to wait on the Lord to see what answer the Lord would give to him. And what we saw there was the first part of God's answer. And the first part of God's answer amounted to the fact that what I'm about to tell you, inscribe in tablets of stone, so that when the vision matures, people will be able to see that indeed I am the Lord. And then he makes this contrast between the Chaldeans or the wicked and those who are righteous. And that's where we ended. The difference was this: behold, his soul is puffed up. It's not upright within him, but the opposite is true of the righteous, and it is this: the righteous shall live by his faith. Essentially, that's where God began his answer. Today, we are moving on to see more of God's answer. And the rest of the answer amounts to this: that God will punish the wicked. He will do it in his own time. He will punish the wicked. He will do it in his own time. But he's going to do it in such a way that it will be on his terms. And his terms amount to this, that it will be for his glory. That's basically what we read in the remainder of chapter 2. And then, God willing, the next time we are back here, we will see how Habakkuk responds finally to that glorious revelation that we are about to look at this evening. So today, we are beginning with verse 6, and I hope we shall appreciate what is coming before us here. So in verse 6, Habakkuk begins by saying, "Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say," and then we have what it is that they will say. Who are all these who shall take up their taunt against Babylon? Well, thankfully, we are told who they are in the previous verse. That's where we ended last week. The previous verse says, "Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, like death, he has never enough." And then here it is. "He gathers for himself all nations and collects all his own peoples." So what he's doing basically is going nation by nation. He is defeating them and adding them to his great empire. And what Habakkuk is saying here, which is really not Habakkuk, but God speaking to Habakkuk, his child, he is saying, this is what's going to happen. These same nations that have been brought into this empire by the Babylonians, or are being brought into this empire, they are the very ones who will shout in excitement and derision because of what will now happen to the Babylonians. What is it that will happen to the Babylonians? Basically, we begin halfway through verse 6 down to the end. And let me just give you an overview before we jump into the details. First of all, remember this is poetry. And we must never make the mistake when you're going through poetry to treat it as though it is simply prose or a narrative and then we're sort of running through it. There is repetition, but the repetition is meant to give a sense of stereo to what is being said, a sense of depth to what is being said. And then also, there is the use of picture language or figures of speech. So as we make our way through here, there will be quite a lot of that, and I'll touch on it every so often. We have five stanzas, beginning with halfway through verse 6, all the way to the end of the chapter. And the five stanzas, each stanza has three verses. So if you quickly peep there, you'll see the first one begins halfway through verse 6 and ends in verse 8. The second one begins in verse 9 and ends in verse 11. The third one from verse 12 to verse 14. The fourth one, verse 15 to verse 17. And then the last one, verse 18 to verse 20. So very neatly packaged. That's why I'm saying it's poetry, and don't easily lose what's happening there. Then the five stanzas are divided into two. So the first bunch has three stanzas, and the second bunch has two stanzas. And the way you easily notice where they are ending is that they end by drawing our attention away from the Babylonians and bringing us to God. Remember, he is saying, I will punish them, but I'm going to punish them on my terms, and my terms are this. It is going to be for my glory. And so you notice at the end of the third stanza, which ends in verse 14, look at what we read there. This is not about Babylon or the Chaldeans, it's about God. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Again, at the end of the last stanza, that is verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. And that's where I have drawn the title of my sermon. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth shut up. Basically, that's what is being said there. The last word by way of introduction, this is a rather lengthy introduction, is that these are wars. Each one of them is saying war to him, war to him, war to him. And each war always begins with what the people being indicted, what wrong they have done. And then goes on to speak about what, as a result, is going to be done to them. Okay, so you won't miss that as we go through. There will always be, this is the wrong they are doing, and then this is the consequence, the negative that's going to happen to them because of what they have done. The major lesson as we make our way through is not simply about the fact that in the midst of our own trials, we ought to remember that God is working out his own purposes, and those purposes are for his own glory. It is also really a lesson to all of us never to become the enemies of God's people, never to use underhanded ways to save our own end in order to use our powers, our advantages, to ill-treat or abuse those who are God's people. Because you can be sure that punishment is coming. And that punishment will be in such a way that you will be put to great shame, but God will glorify himself. We'll see that as we now go through these wars. In the first one, which we see in verse 6b down to verse 8, it is simply saying that those who major on oppressing others will in due season have rebellion on their hands. Those who major in oppressing others will soon find rebellion on their hands. Let's read this halfway through verse 6. Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. For how long? And loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise? And those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoiled for them, because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the peoples, in other words, those who remain behind, shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities, and all who dwell in them. The bottom line there is simply a common feature that God has put in all of us as human beings. And it is this: we by nature want to be free. We by nature want to be happy. So when anyone is riding roughshod over those basic principles that God has put in us as human beings, what happens is, for a while, because power is on his side, he might seem to be prevailing. But what is happening over time is that there is a silent but growing resistance due to that sense of frustration. And it is growing and growing and growing. And a time comes when it basically comes to enough is enough. And that's what has happened across history all the time. When we speak about colonialism, exactly, it was the same thing. It was that the bigger, stronger nations were coming and usurping the place of chiefs across the entire continent, and the people began to groan and groan and groan, and one day, from one end of Africa, someone said, enough is enough, and that cry just began to spread right all over until a complete rebellion had taken place. It is a basic reality that if you are abusing people, especially God's people, a time is going to come when there will be a revolting, a rebellion, because that's the way human beings are. So it doesn't matter whether it's in the home or in the church or in a workplace in terms of environment, we should know that that's the way God has made human beings. In this particular case, the Babylonians were riding roughshod over different nations. They had the weaponry, they had the army, and therefore they were bringing nations to subjection under them. But that's being a fool. It's a matter of time. Rebellion will come. God has put it into the DNA of human beings. The second one had to do with unrestrained selfishness that is seeking to find security ultimately in a position that you can only finally have security in God. You can't, on your own, at the expense of everybody else, be at peace in the world. That's folly. And that's what the Babylonians were doing. They were guilty of it. So let's read verse 9 down to verse 11. It says there, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, listen to this, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. Now notice, it's picture language here. So it's not really a nest that the Babylonians were building. The picture there is that, if you can imagine a bird that is robbing other people's nests of twigs and so on and so forth in order to build a nest that is extremely high and far away from any other birds to reach there. Well, that's basically what Babylon was doing. Impoverishing other nations in order to add more and more to their own military might. Securing themselves more, completely selfish, at the expense of all other nations. Well, what does he say? Basically, it's this. It will backfire. That's basically all it is. It will backfire. You have devised shame for your house. By cutting off many peoples, you have forfeited your life. So you are killing others, but actually it will boomerang at the loss of your own life. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Basically, all it is saying is, yes, that same nest, that same citadel, that same barracks, that same fortress that you have put there, the very walls are the ones that will scream out at you. The very walls will bring you to shame. Again, it's the same basic principle. It's God who has done this, that human beings who are selfishly wanting to feather their own nest, it is a matter of time when the whole situation boomerangs. It comes right round. It backfires upon them. God is not saying that this is the way nature is. He is saying this is the way I, as God, have made human beings, have made society, and it is a matter of time this is going to happen. The third war is basically saying that God will use even human iniquity for his own glory. The very history that is happening, as terrible as it might be, as one nation is overcoming another and another, and thousands of people are being killed, God is not sitting, biting his nails, wondering what he's going to do to stop this onslaught. Rather, it is that the very sin that you are looking at is in fact something God is going to use to reveal himself in due season. Look at the words there in verse 12 to verse 14. And remember, the way it's ending, it is all about God. What have they done wrong? Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. What is going to happen? Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing? In other words, at the end of the entire cycle, you ask yourself, so, what have they gained? Nothing. Because the very kings who are busy securing themselves, you just wake up one day and you find they've been assassinated. Assassinated. The great emperors of history, they would be assassinated in their own citadel, in the very fortress where they are. And everything they would have been living for comes to nothing. And sometimes, once they are assassinated that way, their own children are bundled together and slaughtered like dogs. Slaughtered. So those who are watching are saying, so what was that all that about? What have they gained by the way in which they were abusing other people? It all comes to nothing. And sometimes the very wealth that they were accumulating is now, having been accumulated in one place, is now taken away completely. God is saying that it is from the Lord of hosts, from God himself, that people's labor comes into the fire. They weary themselves for nothing. But there's one
who is laboring away, who's on an agenda, and that agenda is going to, in fact, use all these details of history to finally bring gain and glory to his name. A gain and glory that will never be lost. And here it is. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. What a picture. What a picture. Imagine a sea being covered with water. It's obvious. Otherwise, there is no sea. Because sea is water. It's 100% water. And that's the message that is being conveyed. That this God who is there is a God who is going to be known by the whole of creation. And is going to be known as he is. But here's the point. It is his glory that will be known. It is his splendor that will be known. It is his excellence that will be known. In other words, there will be the whole human race finally bowing in worship. For what the kings are trying to do, to gain a name for themselves, to gain wealth for themselves, and so on, by conquering nation after nation after nation, in the end, it comes to nothing. But for God, it comes to his own glory. That should make us pause for a moment. In our own personal agendas, especially where that agenda is wrong, it is sinful, it is at the expense of others, we need to realize that in the end, it is an activity that is an activity in self-frustration in the end. It is. Because ultimately, that which truly matters is only that which is for the glory of God. That's it. For the glory of God. Everything else, at the end of the day, will be saying, where has all this ended? Where has all this ended? We'll come back to God. Let's go into the second section of these stanzas. Stanza 4. This stanza, which is verse 15, 16, and 17, is now basically saying that all those who have the opposite agenda for God, however much they may be glorifying themselves, experiencing something of the ecstasy of their own pride, God will bring them to shame. God will bring them to shame. Look at this. See, it's a warning. And I love the fact that all the way through this, Babylon is not being mentioned at all. The reason why I love it is because it means that this can be applied to anybody. This is God's general principle of life. So we shouldn't just say, okay, this is about Babylon. No, no, no. Anybody who takes this route, you can be sure what the final end will be. Here it is now. What have they done? Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk. Here is the reason. In order to gaze at their nakedness. Now,
Remember, this is poetry. So nobody is actually buying beer and making other people drink and then taking off their clothes. Nobody's doing that. It's picture language. And being drunk here is in terms of overcoming them. And overcoming them in such a way that you bring them to shame. Kings, princes, peoples have their dignity dragged in the mud. Dragged in the mud. And they are completely helpless as a drunken man. Totally helpless as they are being abused in this way. Well, what will God do to those who are doing this? Verse 16 and 17. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. I think I've made the point there quite clear, that God is basically saying, here you are on a journey to make a name for yourself at the expense of other people. You are making them a song of derision. Other people are laughing at them and scoffing at them because of what you are doing to them. And they are instead praising you. You are the great one, and so on. And the Lord is saying, this cup of wrath, which you are making them to drink, I also have a cup of wrath, which I'll make you drink. And your end will be one of complete shame. And then finally, it is the impotence of idolatry, the impotence of idolatry compared to the greatness of God, the greatness of God himself. This war comes right in the middle rather than at the beginning. But here it is. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies? What I want you to notice, especially here, is the fact that the things that are being made cannot speak. They cannot speak. For its maker trusts in his own creation. That's why it's totally useless. When he makes speechless idols. They can't speak. They are made out of metal. Maybe wood, but they just curved out images. What can they do for you? And then now, woe to him. This is what he has done. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake. And notice, to a silent stone, because it can't speak. The same thing, arise. He asked the question, can this teach? Whether it's made of metal, or made of stone, or made of wood, can it speak? Can it teach? Can it improve your life? Can it enrich your life from the inside out? And then he says, it can't. Look, behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in it. So the Babylonians, as they have been overcoming nation after nation, remember what we learned. They were coming to their idols and sacrificing them, basically saying, it is these idols that are giving us the victory. And what God is saying here is what victory can they give you? What advice have they given you? What have they taught you? Absolutely nothing. They are speechless. They are silent. They have no breath in them. But with respect to God, it is the exact opposite. He is a God who speaks, and is a God who says to us, stop speaking. It's the exact opposite. And that's where he ends. Verse 20 again. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the earth keep silence before him. The point that is being made there is, as we've been learning, he is on the throne. He is ruling history. He is taking history where he wants it to go. He is not biting his nails because some human beings are suddenly becoming extremely powerful and making his people to suffer. No, it is according to plan. That's what is happening. And in his own time, he will bring all that nonsense to a close. In his own time. And in such a way that everybody, when they see, they will go, how? We never thought that this is going to happen, but it has happened. And our response should be that of bowing our knees, rather kneeling and bowing down to worship. That's basically it. That should be our response. The Lord is in his holy temple. We should put our hands to our mouth instead of complaining, instead of doubting, instead of questioning God. We should ultimately simply say, he is the Lord. He is the Lord. A few words by way of conclusion. I have been saying that the experience of Habakkuk is one that all of us will go through one time or another. And it is where you are suffering, and you are suffering at the hands of individuals who are deliberately sold out to wickedness. Part of the suffering is because of being surrounded by a sinful environment, which is what Habakkuk was complaining about. But also part of the suffering is direct persecution that is upon you. And because you're a child of God, you will be praying. You'll be praying, Lord, please bring this to an end. Or another way is simply, Lord, how long? How long, Lord, will this continue going on? What we are learning here, first of all, is that while we are praying, God, in his sovereignty, is already working. In fact, most likely, he began to work out the answer long before you even began to pray. There is a tapestry of history that he weaves together, undisclosed to our eyes, that in the end may completely surprise us when finally God says, okay, now this is the time. It would completely amaze you if you were to then learn what it is that God had already been doing while you were crying to him. It is often like that. I don't know about you, but for me, it happens enough times that I always rebuke myself, because the next time around, again, I'm saying, Lord, how long? When I'm in that situation, how long? So really the answer is, first of all, with respect to the fact that God is working behind the scenes, is we need to stop complaining and doubting. Because God is not indifferent to sin. God is not indifferent to suffering. He is not. We need to have the faith that says, I will sit upon my tower and watch. I will wait upon the Lord and see what he is going to do. But secondly, we need to have the faith that recognizes that in God's own time, he will fix the wrong. In God's own time. He is not our servant. We are his servants. His agenda in history is not that we may be happy now. His agenda in history is that he may be glorified. He's got a more glorious agenda. And therefore, for us, it is to learn not just to trust him, but to worship him. To worship him. That he is in his holy temple, in silence, we bow to him. That's what we should be doing. And as we shall notice, the next time we come to chapter 3, that's basically what Habakkuk does. He worships the Lord. And his concluding words, which I will read out to you now, which we will build towards next time, is in verse 17 and verse 18 of the next chapter. Let me just read those words, and then I will hand over to our song leader. Though the fig tree should not blossom, no fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. Why? Because he's not my servant, I'm his servant. I worship him. I find joy in that he seeks his glory even through my life. Is that what we're going to do? Are we learning in our Christianity, in our religion, in our experiences of the ugliness of life? Are we learning to trust him? Are we learning to worship him? Are we learning to sit silent before this God who is in his holy temple carrying out his sovereign will? May God teach us to do that through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.